This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross.
Batman, Robin.
That's right. We're after some jewel thieves, but our car's been disabled. May we use yours?
Sure, hop in.
No, I meant we'll take yours and you stay here with ours. There might be trouble.
Well, trouble don't bother me none. But if that's the way you feel about it, take her and welcome.
Pretty wooden for superheroes, huh? Apparently one of Batman's special gifts is the ability to survive even the clunkiest portrayal, like that 1949 movie serial. Batman triumphed last summer in the movie that became the highest-grossing film of all time. My guest, Bob Kane, is the creator of Batman. Over the years, he's watched the Cape Crusaders' continuing adventures with alternate pride and horror. Kane created Batman in 1939 and continued drawing him for DC Comics until 1966, the year the Batman TV series debuted. When he gave up drawing Batman comics, Kane started painting Batman on canvas. He's also written several TV screenplays and created a few new characters. Kane has written a new autobiography. It's called Batman and Me. Kane created Batman a year after the debut of Superman comics. The idea of creating a new superhero was initiated by Kane's editor at DC Comics.
Well, I was having lunch with the editor that time, Vincent Sullivan, and he said he was looking for another superhero. Actually, Superman was created in 1938, and the period when I spoke to Vincent Sullivan was 1939. It was about a year later. And prior to that, I was doing fill-in cartoons for DC Comics and making maybe $20, $25 a week. And I asked Vincent Sullivan how much money the Superman artists were making, Siegel and Shuster. He said they were making $800 a week apiece. Now, in 1938, that was comparable to about $5,000 a week today. And I was kind of a poor kid from the Bronx looking to, you know, get wealthy and famous. So I said, hey, for that kind of money, I could create a superhero. So I went home that weekend, and I drew upon some of my early influences. And as I recalled, I was 18 at the time, but when I was 13 years old, I saw a book by Leonardo da Vinci, a book of inventions. And he had one book with a flying machine, an ornithopter, and it was a man on a sled with huge bat wings. And even Leonardo had a quote on that particular invention. It was the first man in flight, the first glider, actually. And the quote was, your bird shall have no other model but that of a bat. And it kind of initiated an idea to me about a Batman. And that was when I was 13 years old. So that weekend, I drew upon that influence. And there were movies I used to be influenced by as a kid, one called The Mark of Zorro, The Dual Identity with Douglas Fairbanks Sr. And that gave me my second influence. During the day, he was a board count in the Southern California in the 1880s. And at night, he became a crusader fighting against the injustices of the dictatorship at that time. And so that was my second influence for the dual identity. And then there was a movie called The Bat. And The Bat was a villain, but he wore a bat costume, and I guess that influenced me for a bat costume also. So they were my three major influences.
Why did you make Batman someone without superpowers? I mean, he was a regular mortal who was very, very fit and very clever, but he didn't really have superpowers like Superman did.
Exactly. For one thing, I didn't want to emulate Superman and imitate it because I thought maybe they wouldn't want that. And I wanted to come up with something original, for one thing. And secondly, I felt that every person that doesn't have superpowers could relate to Batman a lot easier than they could to Superman. In other words, you didn't have to come from another planet to be a superhero. All you had to do was be born rich and build your body into perfection and have the urge to go out and fight crime. So most people like the idea that Batman never had superpowers. They can relate to him a lot quicker than to a superhero with superpowers.
Now, you said that his look, Batman's look, was inspired in part by the Zorro movie that you liked so much. Now, you were, when you were young, in a gang called the Crusading Zorros, and you used to wear hooded masks. What was the connection between the Crusading Zorros that you were a member of as a kid in the Bronx and the Batman look?
Well, to begin with, we wore the Zorro wore a mask at night to hide his identity, So that the desperados that he would apprehend would know him during the day if they saw him. Therefore, they couldn't retaliate. And when I was a kid and living in the Bronx, we had these clubs, that we would all band together to protect ourselves against rival gangs in other neighborhoods. It was pretty tough in the Bronx at that time. And so we wore Zorro masks to hide our identities when we would raid one of the rivals' clubs and kind of beat up on them. And therefore, if they wanted to retaliate, Terry, they wouldn't know who to apprehend because we wore the masks of Zorro. It was a dual identity, so to speak.
You tell a terrific story in your book, Batman and Me, about how when you were young and in this gang, the Crusading Zorros, that you weren't wearing your costume this day, and you were being pursued by a rival gang called the Vultures.
Yeah.
And at one point, before they really beat the heck out of you, at one point you thought that you had overcome them. What was the feeling like then? And I'm wondering if you felt like a superhero for that brief moment when you thought you had outwitted them.
Yeah, well, you see, we were very impressionable, and I was particularly because of my creative mind. And I always related to my influences. Like when I saw James Cagney in The Public Enemy, I thought I was James Cagney. And a famous scene in The Public Enemy occurred when James Cagney thrust a grapefruit into his girlfriend's face because she annoyed him. So I tried out on one of my girlfriends when I was very young, and I pushed a grapefruit in her face one night, and she quickly retaliated by hitting me over the head with a chair, and that cured my penchant for grapefruits and hitting girls in the face with a grapefruit. But at any rate, getting back to your earlier question, which eludes me at the moment. What was that again?
Oh, about if when you had briefly eluded the Vultures, if you felt like
yeah.
a superhero.
Exactly. So when I was caught by this Vulture gang, I was heading toward my neighborhood, and we had a lumber yard that we used to play out in with a lot of nooks and crannies, and I knew it very well. And somehow that early evening, none of my gang members were around and to join me in the fight. And so I jumped over the fence and kind of hid in some of the nooks and crannies until they caught up with me. But then I remembered Zorro's daring do deeds of jumping around when he fought the desperados in the Spanish West. And so I started to climb shafts of lumber. And when I arrived on the highest part of the lumber yard, the highest shafts, I felt like I was King Kong atop the Empire State Building, and I started thrusting these shafts of lumber down on the Vultures who were below in the lumber yard, and then I started swinging around on the pulleys, and I really felt for a moment victorious because I had the advantage for quite a while because I knew the lumber yard and they didn't. But then I fell off one of the shafts of lumber, cascaded down around me when I landed on it, and I fell to the ground. And that's when they all attacked me. There were about six of them. And they really beat up on me pretty badly. They broke my arm and a couple of my front teeth. And then they crushed my knuckles, my right hand, the drawing hand. And actually, this injury inadvertently kept me out of the service in World War II, although I enlisted in the Navy after Pearl Harbor. But I have a kind of partial use of my drawing hand, and I have two porcelain jackets that remind me of that ominous day in the lumber yard when I was a young and reckless boy growing up in the Bronx.
Now,
I really lived a real-life adventure, sort of like the ones I draw today in Batman.
Bob Kane is my guest, and he's written an autobiography called Batman and Me, which includes a lot of excerpts from Batman comics over the years. He originated the comic in 1939. Now, here you were, a Jewish kid growing up in the Bronx, right? Your superhero is named Bruce Wayne. I mean, what a very not Jewish name.
Well, it's an alliteration of Bob Kane.
Oh, okay.
Bruce Wayne.
Well,
alliteration. I wanted to be Bruce Wayne in my reverie and
uh-huh.
in my daydreams. I felt instead of a poor kid, I imagined I'd like to be a rich playboy and fight crime at night. Because I hate all injustices in the world.
Would it have been possible to have made a Jewish superhero, or was that out of the question at the time?
Well, only for the Jewish Forward, which is a newspaper of the Bronx. But that's the only paper that would take a Jewish hero.
Tell me why you decided to draw Batman in tights and shorts. Now, I know Superman was drawn that way.
Well, actually, it's called the Union Suit character. And for whatever reason, Superman started it, and it seemed to work. And mine was second, except I used a bat cape and the bat symbols, the bat mystique, which spread out into the bat cave, the batmobile, the batarang, and so forth. I used the entire bat mystique to create my bat world. Superman only had a telephone booth. So mine is really more merchandisable, so to speak, and also more misterioso. Yeah, somehow you enhance an idea. You begin with it. It's just a germ of an idea. And as I studied the history of comics in America, all the comics heroes were very crude at the beginning, and they developed along the way. Like Dick Tracy didn't have a two-way wristwatch when he started. That came along later.
You started off doing slapstick comics and then turned to Batman. How did your drawing style change to create the Batman mood?
Well, I was a very good copyist, Terry, and I was able to copy superheroes at an early age. At 15, I could copy Flash Gordon almost as well as the artist who drew him, Alex Raymond. And I used to dabble in copying all the comics, slapstick as well as the illustrative kind. And the reason for my adaptation and switching over to the illustrative art rather than slapstick art was simply because there was more money in the superhero. Like when I asked Vincent Sullivan how much money the Superman artists were making, they were making $1,600 between them during any given week, and I was making $25. So I did that because of the money, basically. Intrinsically, I really would rather draw slapstick comics. I've always been a great lover of the early Mutt and Jeff and Popeye and Maggie and Chigs, and those were the comics that I grew up on that I wanted to emulate and become a slapstick comic artist. But I realized that the illustrative superhero was probably my forte for making money and fame.
Batman was obviously inspired by the success of Superman. What was the reaction initially of the Superman artists to Batman? Did they think that you were just stealing from them?
No, not really, because Batman really was nothing like Superman in costume or in the general genre. Superman came from a Krypton, another planet, and he had superpowers. He could fly and leap great heights over buildings, where Batman was merely a mortal that wore a bat costume. And no, they weren't surprised, because they knew that there would be a whole slew of imitative superheroes to come. And mine was second. And frankly, Terry, after Batman and Superman, there really wasn't another original superhero in the last 50 years. All they are offshoots, and one way or another, of new costumes based on Superman and Batman. A few of them don't have superpowers like Bruce Wayne, Batman. Most of them do have superpowers, but nobody other than Spider-Man, which came along about 25 years later, and it's kind of a unique character, and it looks like a spider. It's amazing, though, how all the characters other than Superman took on the names of insects, animals, and so forth, if you want to analyze it.
Did you ever see a bat when you were growing up?
Well, I had great fears of bats. And therein lies an amazing dichotomy also. The fact that who thought any character with a name like a Batman would go, only because even my publisher at that time thought it was a very ominous name, and he suggested I change it. And I said, well, why don't we try one issue and we'll see how it goes. But when the issue sold out, and I came to him and I said, well, what about changing the name? Let's call him Irving Schwartz the Tailor, or whatever. He laughed and he said, no, let's keep the name, because, you know, obviously the bottom line in any industry, in motion pictures and comic books, is money. If you're making money, you stay with it.
Let's take a short break, and then we'll talk some more about Batman. And my guest is Bob Kane, who created Batman Comics in 1939, and he continued drawing Batman for DC Comics until 1966. He's written a new autobiography called Batman and Me. This is Fresh Air. Bob Kane is my guest, the creator of Batman. You drew Batman for DC Comics. You stayed with that house. What are some of the pros and cons of doing a comic for a comic book house like that? Who owns the rights to the characters, for instance?
Unfortunately, that's that's part of the negative part of the business, is that when you're young, you sell away your copyrights, and actually it's that happens with most of the cartoonists, and they own the character at that time, I couldn't take it elsewhere, and actually I was making very good money, and in 1940-41 I was making practically $1,000 a week, and so you're not about to leave, and $1,000 a week in 1940 was comparable to about $5,000-$6,000 today a week. And so being that they owned the copyright, I did the best I could at the time by compromising and getting a good piece of the action and a perpetuity contract. So therefore, I did rather well compared to some artists who sold it away and didn't get very much out of it.
Have you owned a piece of the merchandising over the years?
Yes, I do. Mm-hmm. I do rather well.
I'll bet, yeah.
I mean, all things being equal, I'd love to own it, and I would have done 1,000% better, but I didn't do badly the way it turned out, and life is a compromise. If it weren't for the publisher, I probably, I never would have been where I am today. So, you know, one hand washes the other.
How did the comic book code affect you in 1954, and the code restricted content matter of the comics? And this was a period
See, for a while, what happened was whenever there's a successful industry, you generally have some sleazy fly-by-nights that want to cash in on it and on the coattails of anything famous. And so a bunch of these fly-by-night publishers came out with some really schlocky, if I could use that word, books that depicted sex that we never had, blatant sex, you might say, violence, cutting heads off with the blood oozing out, and they had bad grammar and illicit wordage and so forth. And so a lot of the whole industry suffered along the way with its sleazy books, because a lot of mothers stopped their children from reading comic books in general, including the DC line and other books of our good caliber. So what happened is a code was set up, like in the early days of the motion picture industry, they had the Hays office, which was a code of ethics of what you could do or what you could show or not show on the screen. If there was too much sex and violence, they cut down on that. I think a censorship is good to a degree, but if you have too much censorship, you take away the freedom of the press and the writer and the artist and so forth.
Were your freedoms restricted? Were there things that you wanted to do and couldn't do when the code was put into practice?
Oh, no. No, our books were never... We censored our own books, so we weren't under the fire of the anti-comic book people and the parents' associations and so forth. No, our books were always clean, so we had nothing to worry about. We just had a sit tight, and then we had a code which the good comic book publishers created, and which had to have every drawing had to have a stamp of approval by the Comics Code of America, and then this knocked out the sleazy comic books only because they couldn't get the code of approval, therefore they couldn't get any distribution, so they stopped publishing, and they only interfered maybe a year or two, and then they all died out. And we went on our merry way publishing clean comic books, as they are and have been all through the years.
There are still Batman comics now, yes?
Oh, sure. I mean, we have ghost artists. In fact, the new breed of Batman comics are graphic novels, and they're done with hardcovers. Some of them are $30 a book, some are $25 a book, and they're done on beautiful paper. There's been a whole evolution since the days I created Batman for 10 cents a comic book. Now, Batman number one, that I don't own. The 1939 book, the May issue of Detective Comics, has started in 6 pages, now sells for $50,000. There are only about 12 in the country, and I don't have one of them. I had them, 1 to 100, but my first wife threw them all out when I got divorced. But anyway, one day I'll get number one back, I guess.
Just briefly, can you tell us what you thought of the movie Batman? You were a consultant to that.
Yes, I was project consultant, and I did add a lot of my input. I drew the costumes. I said the costume has to be rigged with wire that when he jumps through a skylight, it'll billow out behind him like a bat. And I critiqued the script and so forth. I thought it was very true to the roots of Batman, the way I started it, whence it came. In other words, Batman had gone back to the Mysterioso, dark, brooding Batman that I created in the early years. I love the campy version, but never I really prefer the dark, brooding version. And I think the sets were marvelous. The whole mood of the movie had a different film noir look. And look, it grossed over $250 million. It's one of the all-time top grosses in Hollywood from the time of its inception. And in Europe, it'll probably make another $200 million. And plus the merchandising and the video cassettes, the Batman could very well go to $1 billion. That's more than any movie ever earned or ever will earn in the history of movies. And I love the movie. I thought it just was true to my original dark brooding. I was just worried it shouldn't turn into a campy TV show again, and it did not. It followed faithfully my early mood of the genre of Batman.
Well, Bob Kane, I want to thank you very much for talking with us. Thank you.
Thank you, Terry. I really enjoyed it. God bless, and we'll see you in the movies of Batman 2.
All right.
Okay.
Bob Kane is the creator of Batman, and he's written a new autobiography called Batman and Me. It's published by Eclipse Books. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.